This is the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, with Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kaharski on 104.5 The Zone.
Coming up in an hour, appointment listing. Greg Cosell will join us on the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. He has watched every third down pass attempt from Ryan Tannehill's 2019 season. He gives us his assessment of the Titans quarterback. That's coming up at 12:15, plus primary complaint a bit later. Doug Matthews about to join us, but first let's hit a couple of some headlines out there over the last several minutes, starting with the TSSAA and their Board of Control meeting, Chad.
Yeah, Will Bowling texting me, got back in on the meeting and heard another possible option, and this was something they added while he was on with us. The TSSAA has asked the governor's office if they might consider putting the TSSAA in the same category with in-state college and pro teams, which are not included in the governor's executive order. So that is another option. I would say that's highly unlikely that the governor would give them that exemption with high school football. But certainly something else to note that was brought up from the TSSAA is another possible option. Guys, listening to Will and everything that's out there, I like option number two. Start at September 18th, play 8 regular season games, shorten it from 32 teams in the playoffs to 16, take the number 1 and 2 teams in each region, and let's roll. And then you're finishing the season in mid-December at that point, and it looks very close to a normal high school football season at that point.
And, Paul, we have some hub cities for the NHL.
Yeah, report out of Canada, it's Edmonton and Toronto. So Canada will be host. I saw a great question on top of that report from Bob McKenzie. So a great question asking, where will the Stanley Cup final be? And I don't know that, as we've talked about Hub City, that's been answered as to which one will get the marquee ending to the whole deal. I don't know that's been answered here. So this says, barring any last minute complication, and we've seen some of those, parentheses, Vancouver and Las Vegas, the two NHL hub cities will be Edmonton and Toronto, and that's from Bob McKenzie.
And they're not going to Vegas. They're not going to Vegas because of the rise in COVID-19. It was going to be held at the Park MGM and the surrounding plaza. And instead, they're going to Canada. The West will go to Edmonton. The East goes to Toronto. Phone lines available, 737-1045, as we go on the road to begin this hour, presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office. We say hello to Doug Matthews. Coach, good morning.
Good morning. Hope you all are doing well. I'm sure you are.
Yeah, doing very well. Always great to have you on the show. And as always, Doug is presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office. Designate a sober game plan. If you've been drinking, don't drive. The Tennessee Highway Safety Office reminds you that fans don't let fans drive drunk. Coaches are planning for the best, preparing for the worst, Doug. The manpower and the work behind the scenes to pull all of this off should not go unnoticed. I think the common perception from the average fan is, oh, there's no sports, so there's nothing going on in sports, and that's not the case. Can you explain the amount of planning behind the scenes that's going on to make college football happen?
Well, we're reminded in situations like this, you have the same thing with the Titans, the pro teams, and all those different things. It's the people that you don't think about so much outside looking in. You certainly do if you're on the inside part of it, but you know, everybody that has anything to do with the facility being open, from the people who open it up, from the people who clean it, from the people who are there responsible for it, all the technology people that are in there. Of course, game days for game days, just think of all the people that are involved in that. Many of those people are volunteer. And one thing on that, most of them, well, I won't say most, I'll say a good number of them, are older. Most of your ushers and things like that, people that take the tickets, are retired people that just love being around whichever university they're at. But The planning and the preparation that's gone into this has been extant, but the other part of it is they've had a lot of time to look at it now. You know, they've had really, what are we, 4 months now, something like that, that they've been working on all these different scenarios. They've been getting more information as they put this all together. And, Jonathan, everything I hear is that I think we're talking about college athletics now, college football, and I think basketball to a certain extent, and probably other fall sports. These athletic directors have this under control. They know what they're going to do. They got various avenues that they can go as we go along, particularly in the month of July that is going to be so important. Then they'll know exactly which one of those paths they're going to take. But they've got the roads. They've got the path laid out from playing in front of a full crowd to not playing at all. Now, there's not a whole lot of concern right now or belief that they will not play at all. But I would say the odds of getting a full house in there are going down daily.
Time has been on football side at every level, but that time is coming to a close. They want to push the decision back as far as they need. And, of course, that's the smart play here. That way you can analyze the information as late as possible to make a decision. Do you have a sense of when a decision will need to be made on some of the bigger questions in the return to football?
Well, you are correct on that. Time is on the side. You know, one of the things to look at, of all the collegiate sports, football was the one that was least affected because of the shutdown, which happened, somewhere in the first part of March. Now, it did affect spring practice, but the season was already done, and basketball was still going on, both men's and women's. You had all of the spring sports. Some didn't even start. So football's had, they've really been unaffected by it. Now, the athletic part's been affected financially, but not because of the football end of it. So now, as they had their planning going, the people that I'm talking to, and of course I don't talk to the commissioner, but he's pretty open on this, and you can kind of put two and two together, really. Common sense, if you look at what other conferences are saying, Bob Bowlesby in particular, we've talked about him in the past, from the Big 12. He is kind of the spokesman, it seems, and I've been told, listen to him. He knows what's going on. He's on almost all of the committees. But the 15th of July is when everything kind of really ramps up. And I want to repeat what I've said in the past. That is normally in the past 10, 20, 30 years, that's when it has ramped up. Second semester summer school is really when all the players normally came back on that. So this June has really been a bonus from that standpoint. And I believe that most everybody who come back has come back in June. Some have not. Oklahoma being the one power school that is not. But there's been others, too. I think they feel very comfortable the fact that they got their players in, they got them tested, they worked with the ones who had positive tests. And I think they feel like they're in really good shape right now. But, Jonathan, I would say July 15th is kind of that's they have a little bit more information. And then you have to believe that the 29 days before the first ball game, whenever your first game is, if it's September 5th, it's somewhere around August the 5th, that fall camp starts. I think they need to have a pretty good idea by then, and I think they will. The thing that's kind of up in the air right now is that, let's just take the Southeastern Conference. There's 11 states that are involved in the Southeastern Conference. So that means that you have 11 different state governors who are, handling the situation for their state. So all those things kind of have to work together, but in most every one of these instances, they are working together on this. One pretty good thing, I think, is remember, it seems like we know the age group that is most affected by the COVID-19 virus, and we know that also locations, cities, because of the density of people, are the other part. Well, really, Nashville, Vanderbilt's the only is the only university in the Southeastern Conference football program, Southeastern Conference, that's really in a big city. Knoxville, I guess, maybe would be maybe the next biggest, I guess. But most of them are in smaller communities. So I think that'll play a part in it, too.
Phone lines are open if you want to talk some college football and what planning looks like from a coach's perspective with a lot of uncertainties out there. You can ask Coach Doug Matthews your questions, and let's talk some football. 615-737-1045, 737-1045.
On the Road with Doug Matthews, presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office. Coming up, we will discuss college football scheduling contingency plans, and we'll hone in on the SEC scheduling contingency plans with Doug Matthews. That's next. But first, Doug, let us know about your friends at Stroud's.
Well, Stroud's Barbecue, really through this whole situation, this whole pandemic, the way they've covered it and everything, because they have drive-through locations at all of their locations, they've been really doing just about as much business as they were before. People love to get out of the house. They still have that going, and they are still going to continue their delivery service, StroudsDelivery.com. Essentially, you go online, you get the menu, you choose what you want. You pay for it. You tell them when you want it delivered. They'll be there within 15 minutes of the time that you give them on that. So they are still there, and they still, of course, are just a pooch punt away.
Time to talk all things college football as we go on the road with Coach Doug Matthews, presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office.
On the Road with Doug Matthews, presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office. If you're planning to drink, don't plan to drive. The Tennessee Highway Safety Office reminds you that fans don't let fans drive drunk. 615-737-1045, our number. Doug Matthews with us.
So, Coach, in line with hoping for the best and planning for the worst with everything that's going on, Jeremy Pruitt went on the Dan Patrick Show this morning and said that Tennessee still has not had one player or coach test positive for COVID-19 so far. Is it realistic to expect that to continue, the good luck they've had with that so far, or is there always the plan, not even just the plan, the knowledge that you're going to have multiple players at some point test positive?
Well, I think you certainly have to believe that you're going to have that. One of the interesting things that about this is, you know, you look at the Southeastern Conference schools, most of them, particularly, especially in some selected areas, but most of them, you throw Clemson in there and a few other ACCs, they recruit the same players pretty much. And a lot of the players come from the same area. And kind of unusual, you know, Clemson's had, what, over 20, I think, positive tests. Tennessee has not had any. A little unusual on that. I would say it's probably more luck than anything else. But I would have to believe that they are certainly expecting, maybe it won't work out, but they're probably expecting to have a few of those. And you know, Chad, again, this is the thing I keep trying to get out there, is that's the reason for the June openings. That's the only reason for the June openings. Programs do not get back together. Now, granted, there was a spring practice that was missed. But programs don't get back together for the fall season until after July the 4th. The last couple of weeks in June and the first week in July were normally when coaches are out vacationing, all of them. You have a skeleton crew in the facility. So they have prepared for it, that part of it. And I'm a little surprised when I see some schools who bring players back and then shut back up again because they had some positive tests when – that's the reason that you bring them back on campus, to identify the players who will test positive. My guess is, and it's just a guess, but I think it's pretty educated, those programs that are shutting down and going back again is because of leadership, probably the way the university wants it, and also I think a cost factor on it. They're looking at that also. But I don't see a reason to open up, come back in, and then when you get a few tests, positive tests, to shut her back down again, because if you weren't expecting those tests, I don't think you'd probably have them back in anyway this early.
Well, and Kansas State and Clemson, the two differences there, right, Coach? Kansas State had less positive tests than Clemson. They send everyone home. Clemson's got 37 now football players that have tested positive. They continue to work out.
Well, and why would you not? Just think about it. You bring them back in for the reasons I just stated. You get a few positive tests. Now you're sending them back home. Where are you going to be taken care of best? There's no doubt in my mind that it's going to be for the great majority of players, it's going to be there on campus where you have trainers and physicians and specialists that work with the athletic department. As I mentioned before, if it gets more serious than that, almost every one of the major universities, state universities, have a medical school. Most of them have university hospital. So that part of it I didn't understand. I really didn't.
Doug, why do you think some universities are reporting their positive test numbers and others are staying quiet?
If it were me and I was running a program, I would not put anything out there either. Some of it has to do, and there's a little bit debate about this, and you could probably go either direction on this, but some believe that the HIPAA laws, the federal laws that that you cannot give any student of a university, you cannot give out any medical results on that, any medical history, anything from a university standpoint, that would, of course, go down to the athletic department also. And others say, well, as long as you don't mention their name. But, I don't know of a reason to put that out there other than just to put it out there. I don't see how it's going to help you at all. Now, I'm talking about publicly. You want your players, you want people who are associated with the program to certainly know about it. But I would say that's the biggest reason. I don't really see a reason. And I'm talking about from a athletic department standpoint. I don't see the benefit, any benefit that they get other than lack of criticism, to put the numbers out there or the fact that they have or they haven't.
Doug, what are some of the scheduling contingency plans that you know about for college football? If a game is canceled for a spike in COVID cases during a week in the season, let's say it's Tennessee-Alabama week in October, and that game is postponed because they just simply can't play it based on a spike in numbers, how are they going to make that game up prior to the conference championship game?
Well, there's a couple of scenarios to look at here. And I think most of us with common sense would figure this out. The part of the schedule that needs to be protected, if you can only play a partial schedule, would obviously be your conference games, which in the Southeastern Conference is 8. Some of them are 9. Play 9 conference games. That would be protected. So the first thing that would go away, let's say Alabama, Southern Cal. If they're gonna cancel games, that would probably be one. Georgia plays Virginia, those non-conference games. But what the Southeastern Conference has looked at with the other Power Five conferences that I think makes some sense, and this is on the table right now. It won't have to be really voted on or in place until later on in August, is to have the conference championship game of all these conferences the December 5th weekend, that first Saturday and Friday in December. So what they're looking at now is moving to the second one. Again, not permanently, but right now they could move that. That would give you the opportunity, Jonathan, that if you had a conference game, not a non-conference game, but if you had a conference game that had to be canceled or postponed, you could move it to that date, and you could have multiple games played on that weekend. Now, the reason the other Power Five conferences would have to be in line with this is because, as we know, after championship weekend, that's when the college football playoff is all set. It would not really affect anything because with the December 5th, that first weekend of December, when they pick the college football playoffs and the bowl games, you have for the college football playoff, you have the December 31st. So you got 3.5 weeks or so, in some instances 4 weeks to get there. So one more week would not affect that amount. That makes quite a bit of sense to me. And I think it probably won't be a hard and fast rule or regulation, but I think the conferences will get to that, knowing that if that happens, we're going to move that conference championship game back a week and have a makeup weekend.
So Josh Palmer, Tennessee receiver, went on a podcast, and I'm going to read the quote. He said, "At this point, any fans out there, if you guys don't support us as human beings, don't come to the games, because I'd rather have nobody in the stands than a bunch of fakes who pretend to like us because we entertain them. Trey Smith then followed up and said, I second that 100%. Now, since then, both players have released a follow-up statement to that that I thought were very well done and well prepared as to what exactly they were saying and how much they love the Tennessee fan base. But, Coach, if you're Philip Fulmer, the athletic director, or you're anyone in charge of marketing, especially in these uncertain times with everything going on, what would your reaction be to a player saying, I'd rather play in front of no fans than these fans?
Well, that, you know, I do not know Palmer at all. But, you know, the one of the things that I'm working on for this weekend shows, anytime you have any type of protest or trying to get things changed, regardless of where it is, but let's just talk about college athletics right now, the danger is in overreaching. I think we mentioned last Sunday, and I've certainly mentioned it on the weekend shows, I think some of these athletes, and I'll use Texas as an example, went about what they would like to see happen the right way. They didn't go in demanding anything. They just said, hey, these are some things that we are concerned about. Would you look at these? Well, that's the way you get things done. Then you have other athletes who come out and say, well, if they don't do this, I'm going to do this. Well, you're not going to win that. That's not the way the world works. It may sound good. You may get a lot of people say, boy, I'm with you. But then when you turn around when it's time to do something, there's nobody behind you. So I think that's the concern there. I don't ever like to see that. I don't like to see, but let me go further than that. I've been very outspoken in the past. I don't like to hear head football coaches say that nobody thought we could win except the players and the people in this room. Well, in Tennessee's case, and put your own school in there, 100,000 people don't show up because they don't think you can win. So I think this is a matter they just maybe misspoke a little bit. That's the world, though, that we live in. Coach Fulmer and I had a big conversation about this a couple of weeks ago. You know, when I was coaching, and up to, what, 15 years or so ago, there was no social media. But you know now that your players are going to say things, and you live with it. Hopefully you've educated them. And when I say educated, I mean at least let them know, hey, listen, what you say people are going to see, and they're going to put their spin on it. I don't think Josh Palmer believes that players don't want to support them. Fans don't want to support them, but you know, that's the way you can kind of interpret some of those things. Anytime you know, we all know this, we've had to do it ourselves. Well, I'll speak myself. I've had to do it myself after I said something on a show. When you realize that it didn't come out quite the way you said it, you always have to come, anytime you have to come back and kind of clarify something, you probably didn't handle it the right way the first time. But I know, nothing Josh or Trey, certainly backing him up, said really is going to have any effect on from a university standpoint, certainly.
So I'm asking Coach Doug Matthews this question. I want the coaching perspective, the coaching business perspective on this. People all over America have been laid off or furloughed because their jobs aren't needed during the safer at home orders and everything else going on in the country. College football coaches are paid ultimately to produce a product 12 weeks a year. And that's what they're guaranteed. And everything they do around the clock in recruiting and practice and everything else gears up to those 12 games in the fall. If there is a scenario, and I firmly believe this scenario will play out, where certain teams either will have to cancel their season or they're going to have to miss games because of an outbreak of COVID-19, do athletic directors dare go to these powerful college football coaches and say, we're taking away a percentage of your pay because we didn't play the amount of games you're supposed to coach this year because of extenuating circumstances? Or are coaches the ones who are protected from all of this and they're not going to see a pay cut with whatever happens this season?
No, they certainly will see a pay cut. Matter of fact, I've been watching and reading. I've got a couple of websites that I can go to and see what's happening in college athletics administrative level. And I noticed we've seen some of the smaller programs. where we've seen coaches, athletic directors, coaches take reductions in pay. I think Michigan is the first one, and I'm going to probably get the percentages wrong here, but the athletic director, the head football coach, head basketball coach, and I think anybody making over a certain amount of money is taking a 10, 15, 20% reduction, depending on what level they're at. So if Michigan's doing that, and now Michigan is one of the schools, they have a tremendous amount of sports. I think Tennessee has somewhere around 16 to 18 sports, and it depends on how you count cross country and diving and swimming and all that. Michigan, I think, is up closer to 30, so they have many, many more sports that they have to fund. But, no, that's going to happen. And you know what? These coaches know this. They know that, if you're making $3, $4 million and you play half a season or you don't play any season at all, you're going to get docked a little bit on that. The good thing is, though, that the money eventually will be there because of the TV contracts and things like that. So I think all the athletic director will sit down. First off, even though all these athletic departments, this is important to remember, they are not funded by any tax dollars. The major universities are not funded by any tax dollars. So while, yes, they are part of the university, all their funding, none of their funding comes from the university itself. But even with that, you know, if you see the president and the vice chancellor and, whoever in the academic world taking pay cuts, it's not a good look. And I would think that most of those athletic directors, I know the one at Tennessee will, because he was a student there. He's been at that school for 35 years. He'll be the first to take a cut, and the coaches will have to follow on that. There'll probably be a dollar figure, maybe $75,000 or higher, from other employees. But if it continues going like that, they're not going to have any choice, but they're going to have to do that. You're going to have to make budget cuts, and personnel is one of the big costs when it comes to athletic departments.
Do you think other coaches, other sports, wind up taking 10%, 15%, whatever university policy is, or you think they try to leave that stuff alone?
No, I think they will, Paul. Now, again, I would have to believe that, again, I'm just talking about Tennessee. I know more about that, but I'm the chancellor, the president, of course, he'll be obviously watching everything, but he's the president, oversees the system. But the chancellor of UT Knoxville, certainly, that he's had, she's had conversations, Dr. Plowman's had conversations with Philip Fulmer. So absolutely they'll take a cut, because here's the other part of it. Every other sport except men's basketball is funded because of profits made by football, and in some instances basketball. Basketball's a little bit more than break even, but every other sport's funded by that. So if the head football coach and the people who are bringing in the money, the sport that's bringing in the money, take cuts, the rest of them are going to have to take it too. Again, there will be a point, whatever the dollar figure is, that you're making, that it, the percentages will be different. But if this thing gets to where they're not playing ball games and money's not coming in, every coach on that campus will take a cut.
Doug, LSU loses a lot. And reading last night, if you just look at the first three rounds of the NFL draft, LSU Tigers are all over the place on this sheet. And the top pick, of course, in Joe Burrow, they lose him. They lose their passing game coordinator in Brady. No other quarterback in the country has bigger shoes to fill than Miles Brennan, who has been waiting for his opportunity to start at quarterback for the Tigers. What do you expect from LSU? Expectations are high coming off the massive record-breaking season they had offensively. But when you look at who they're replacing, do the expectations meet the product on the field coming up?
I'll tell you what was interesting, Jonathan. Last night, didn't have a whole lot to do, so I was watching I was watching the sports channels. The SEC Network had the Texas LSU game from last year. That was the first or second game of the year. That was kind of when Joe Burrow and the offensive performance that we were going to see all year long from LSU was there. And then I think it was ESPN, one of the ESPN networks, might have been the ESPNU, but one of the ESPN networks had the national championship game. And I watched both of those. And when you watch what happened at Texas and then saw the way that, that LSU performed in the national championship game against Clemson, you could see the growth, but you could also see the tremendous talent. This is just kind of off my the top of my head, but I don't follow awards very much after the season. But I believe if you look, you know, LSU had the head coach of the year, they had the assistant coach of the year, they had the Heisman Trophy, they had the wide, the most valuable wide receiver, got the award for that, the Biletnikoff Award. I think they had like five or six positions where nationwide they were the they won the award for that position. I don't know that that's ever been done before. And to watch that offense against an outstanding, and I mean an outstanding, Clemson defense, the way they picked that apart, you just can't duplicate that. You had a quarterback who just played exceptionally well. And to answer your question, Brennan's under a lot of pressure in some instances, but not in others. I don't think that anybody that follows that program would really expect him to play anywhere like Joe Burrow this year. But he's under pressure. But, you know, he knew that going there. If you are a big-time quarterback and you go to a big-time football program, you know you're going to be under pressure. You're going to get, as the old saying goes, you've got to get a lot of credit when you don't deserve it. You're going to get a lot of blame when you don't deserve it. And I'm sure he understands that.
Doug, I know this weekend, Saturday, of course, July 4th, but you will be on the air. No days off for the coach, and it starts at 9 a.m., Fort Cliff Systems football Saturday, and, of course, Big Orange Sunday every Sunday morning. What do you have coming up this weekend?
Full show. Let me take Big Orange Sunday first. I'm going to continue my look at the kicking game and the techniques involved in that. This week it's going to be kickoff returns and when to return, when not, how to catch the ball, the technique on all of that. And then the Bud Ford segment is going to be the 40 years. This is, I think, will be very interesting to a lot of folks. We're going to take a look at the 40 years when Bob Woodruff and then Doug Dickey, 40 consecutive years of athletic directorship and the growth and the explosion of Tennessee athletics, not just football, but across the spectrum, not only in facilities, but also in championships and in programs that I would consider, from me looking at it, the golden age of Tennessee athletics. Again, from almost every sport, track, basketball, football, women's basketball, swimming, diving, all those different things, baseball, a couple of NCAA tournaments on that. So I think people will find that interesting. I hope they do.
Absolutely. Doug, thank you as always, and we will catch up with you next week. We'll be listening this weekend.
Will do. Thank you.
Doug Matthews on the road with us, and he's presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office. Coming up, an announcement that, quite frankly, we all saw coming, which made the reaction last night surprising. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone. Coming up in 30 minutes, Greg Cosell will join us. We will get into his assessment of quarterback Ryan Tannehill on third down, his third down passing numbers, and the X's and O's behind the execution of those plays, what worked, what didn't, what he thinks the Titans and Arthur Smith can expand upon in 2020. That's coming up at 12:15, a very thorough discussion. Then at 1:15, primary complaint. And, guys, I'm requesting to back cleanup today.
Oh, all right. I always like it when somebody requests to back cleanup. Always hate it when somebody requests to back cleanup, and I'm wondering if I've got something good. I have to go through my emails to myself. How do you track? I mean, we all have systems for tracking our stuff. I do different things. For different segments, I do different things. Primary complaint, I email myself stuff periodically with PC as the subject line, and then I just search PC as the subject line in my emails. And some weeks I know there's going to be good stuff there. Some weeks I know there's not. Other weeks I have no idea what I've put there, and this is one of those weeks.
I have never had a single issue coming up with a primary complaint. Honestly, I don't think I've ever jotted one down. I just always remember something when I'm out and about. And then once it gets to Wednesday, it's like something goes off in my brain on Wednesdays that, oh, yeah, I was at that drive-thru and this happened, and now I've got to talk about it. Or I'm just looking around a room and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's what I was going to talk about on Wednesdays. Occasionally, if it's a little bit longer and more detailed, if it's a story or something, I'll clip it and put it in the notes in my phone to make sure that I have it ready to go. But, yeah, I'm always ready for primary complaint. And Hutton clearly is ready for primary complaint today, going ahead and requesting the cleanup spot.
Yeah, it occurred during my reading last night. So,
you always know if you've got a biggie, a golden one.
Yeah, the ball's on the tee with this. Again, that's coming up at 1:15. One of the things that I was reading through last night, Paul, and I know you agree because you brought it up unsolicited prior to the show this morning, the reaction to there not being minor league baseball this year. Didn't we all expect that to be the announcement?
Yeah, this could have been maybe a primary complaint. I guess the moment that it became official, allowed everyone, this is one of my Twitter beefs also, just the level of lamenting. I mean, we all have a fondness for minor league baseball to some degree.
It's fun to go to the games. Yeah.
Yeah. I think most people's are like ours. Like, we enjoy a night at the ballpark with a beer or a drink and a hot dog and socialization, and you plug into the game here and there for the big moments, probably. My kid enjoys it more as a baseball game and tells me more about what's going on. And it's fun on that level. Other people are pining for it on different levels and get more into the baseball than that. But I was just struck by the level of lament last night for the loss of minor league baseball. Not because I disagree with the sadness of there being no minor league baseball, but because we've known for months that there was going to be no minor league baseball. So,
they could barely play Major League Baseball.
Yes, I guess the official announcement is a trigger for everyone to post their salute and sad funeral comment. But my goodness, I just found in my timeline the outpouring was somewhat ridiculous.
Without naming a specific name, because I think almost everyone is guilty of this, I am becoming more and more convinced that there is some sort of local media text chain or email blast that's sent out that says, tweet this exact thing out at the exact same time when something like this happens. And Paul, you're right. The lamenting over a minor league baseball season from everyone in local media is astonishing to see. And I'm reading all of the same thing. The other one is the mask thing. It's like everyone decided on one day that, like, okay, here's the day that the media, local sports media in Nashville, is going to take a picture of themselves wearing a mask and talk about the importance of the mask. Am I missing these email blasts or the text chain
where everyone sends out the exact same tweet
at one time?
What was the tweet
I've talked
last
a lot
night?
Recently about obligation tweets and how I'm against them. And if I feel like I'm being compelled to tweet something, typically I won't, because I hate feeling like I'm obligated to tweet something if I don't want to tweet it. And I feel like everyone in local Nashville sports media is on the obligation tweet train about everything. And yesterday, it just happened to be about minor league baseball.
Yeah, and I think it makes them phony, to be honest with you. If you're sending out an obligation tweet on an issue, even a death, like, if you don't have something unique to say on the subject, then I'd think, don't say anything. I don't tweet at a super high rate. I think my rate goes up when the Titans are going on, right? Because that's my area of expertise. But I just don't get it. And so I pledge to you, like, when the minor league baseball thing is going on and I see everybody tweeting about it, that makes me less likely to tweet out. I pledge to you, I will not be heard in that. David?
Well, if you guys were in studio like you should be, you would hear my award-winning updates. And the fact that Pat O'Connor, who is the president of the governing body for minor league baseball, is saying that they are a butts-in-seats type of business. And he's saying that anywhere between 85 and 90% of their revenue comes from actual ticket sales, sales for sponsorships inside the ballparks, and that up to 80 of the 160 minor league teams could be in danger of closing their gates for good because there's no minor league baseball this season without some type of intervention from the government or some type of equity firm investing in those teams. So I think that's where some of that came from yesterday and some of the responses that I was seeing. And it wasn't necessarily for the Nashville Sounds, a AAA affiliate. It was the lower-level teams and lower-level organizations who may never see baseball again.
See, well, I saw a lot more like I'm gonna miss going to the ballpark this year. Nothing second level like you're talking about from the people I follow anyway, and certainly from Nashvillians, Nashville media. Sorry, Hutt.
Isn't MLB discussing doing away with like 30 minor league clubs?
Oh, it was already done. It was already done.
Yeah,
I saw. Now here's what I like. I like minor league baseball because who is the craftiest marketing people in the world are minor league teams that are always coming up with something. And so I can't remember what team it was. I think it was the Bowie Bay Sox, who were already selling their t-shirts from their undefeated season that had their logo on the front and their entire schedule on the back.
Orioles,
and they were marketing their undefeated season t-shirt, be the first to get one. Now that's funny. They're stuck with t-shirts that they can't sell, and they're finding a way to try to market the t-shirts. I love minor league baseball for that.
This may sound sacrilege to the crowd that was worshiping at the altar of all things minor league baseball yesterday, which is everyone in local sports media, but here's an idea. Let's just go ahead and have less minor league baseball teams other than the 30 that have already been cut. I'm sorry, but if you're losing your business because you miss one season and you can't sustain it, that's not a sustainable business, especially with all these clubs. So many minor league teams have furloughed their employees, laid off employees. If your one cost is whatever the operating budget is to keep a baseball diamond that doesn't have people going to it, and this one season of lost revenue is going to put you under, then you probably shouldn't be in business to begin with.
Well, I'm going to debate you on this. They've been in business because Major League Baseball has been able to abuse them, basically, and let them operate on a shoestring budget doing this. If you're into player development, if you're the Tampa Bay Rays, you simply have to invest more.
Yeah.
You're getting away with murder on player development by giving virtually nothing to your minor league teams, letting them come up with Sausage Fest night to draw in the German population. And do whatever. They need to invest more in player development beyond having a good pitching coach down there who's teaching spin rate the same way the major league coach is teaching spin rate, and invest some money where these guys make a livable wage and there's more of a budget beyond these guys having to sell undefeated season t-shirts when things go off the rails.
It's sad when the players in Major League Baseball, David Price, have to give everyone in their club $1,000.
Because of owners.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just the structure. You're right, Paul. The structure is set up against the minor league clubs.
They've gotten away with murder.
Yeah. David Reed's got some headlines for you when we return. Greg Cosell just around the corner. Midday 180 queued up by Edley's Barbecue. This is 104.5 The Zone.